This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Attorney General Eric Holder told Russian authorities that NSA leaker Edward Snowden would not face the death penalty or be tortured if he were returned to the United States. Snowden has been living at a Moscow airport since flying in from Hong Kong more than a month ago. He fled the U.S. after leaking details about the NSA surveillance and data mining program. Those disclosures have led to debates about the role and the reach of the NSA. Even the president welcomed discussion on the agency's mandate and mission. The U.S. House almost passed a bill last week that would have limited the agency's authority. We have three guests who are joining us during this hour of Radio Times, and we'll begin with Ken Delanian, national security correspondent in the Washington Bureau for the L.A. Times. And Ken Delanian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So how close was that vote in the House last week to limit the NSA's ability to collect phone records?
The margin was six. So if six votes had changed, the thing would have passed. And that was really remarkable. Nobody expected that. It was an incredible collection of far-right Tea Party Republicans and far-left, some of the most liberal members of the Democratic caucus, coming together and expressing skepticism about, and this is in particular the NSA. There's a lot of surveillance, so we can parse this through, but
sure.
This is the NSA's gathering of U.S. phone records, calling records to and from, not content of communications, in a big old database which they claim they query 300 times a year with known terrorist numbers.
And if this would have passed, what would it, obviously would have had to go to the Senate and gone on from there, but if it had gotten a majority of votes, what would it have said?
Well, it's a defense appropriation bill, so it would have cut off money. I mean, it's a way Congress has of using leverage to stop something it doesn't like. So it would have, nobody believed it would pass the Senate, but it would have been sort of a symbolic blow. You know, even in losing by six votes, it was a small blow in a sense. I mean, it signaled that, you know, large, you know, pluralities in Congress and polls are showing, you know, significant groups of Americans are growing ever more suspicious and concerned about NSA surveillance. And a majority of Democrats voted against their president on that vote, and that was with Nancy Pelosi lobbying. Actually, again, you know, telling people to vote against the amendment.
Do you think the Senate will pick up on this issue? Even some of the Sunday talk shows, there seemed to be some talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's definitely a move to tinker around with some of this stuff. I mean, to, you know, add some, even the proponents, even the Dianne Feinstein, who's the chairman of that Senate Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, Republican, who's the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, have said that they're willing to entertain some kinds of safeguards. They're coming from a place where they believe everything's fine. And in truth, if you believe what the intelligence community says about how it uses this data, you know, maybe there's not so much to be concerned about. But the question is, do we believe it, and can we trust what they're saying? I mean, there's the metadata, you know, who you call and at what time can tell a lot about a person's life. And what they're saying is, we have this all this stuff in a big database, but we don't actually look at it. We only use it to compare against known terrorist phone numbers in very rare cases with permission from the court. So I think a lot of these polls and a lot of this sort of public disquiet is because people haven't really, there's a lot of different surveillance programs right. being discussed, and people think the NSA is reading your email, listening to your phone calls, and they claim that they're not.
There was an interesting piece, actually, in ProPublica. The reporter, I think, went to the NSA to try to get some information through the Freedom of Information Act and was told, quote, there's no central method to search an email at this time with the way our records are set up, unfortunately, which does raise questions about this data and whether anyone can actually access the data, including people that work at the NSA.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as someone who's followed a lot of FOIAs with intelligence agencies,
yeah.
they have a lot of ways of saying no. So I'm
is that right?
Not sure what
okay.
the reason for that. But yeah. I mean, it's what Snowden being able to walk out of Hawaii facility with a thumb drive full of sensitive documents certainly raises questions about whether the data that they've collected on all of us is protected and is secure. And, you know, I could add, there's also similar questions about whether the data that Google and Facebook and a lot of other Twitter has on us is secure and cannot be sort of used in ways that we wouldn't want it to be used.
But do you think members of Congress are responding to the public, whether the public understands it or not? There was a Pew Research Center poll finding that something like 56% of the public concerned about government surveillance and their privacy worries that the government was being too intrusive. Do you think that is influencing what's going on in Washington?
Oh, absolutely. Because the best evidence for that is that Congress has long been briefed on this program. Now, whether most members actually bothered to go and get the classified briefing and learn exactly what it was doing, that's an open question. But certainly the intelligence committees have long known about it and seen, you know, the leaders of Congress knew exactly what was going on, and yet this thing was reauthorized twice, and even in the face of some senators saying, there's some surveillance going on here that if only Americans knew about it, they'd be greatly shocked. I mean, all of us who cover intelligence wrote stories about Senator Wyden saying that.
Exactly.
They passed it, but now that the public has learned about it, we saw with the House vote, and we're seeing with public statements from various lawmakers that the tune has changed.
But are they shocked that this has been going on?
There's some instances of members, particularly in the House, who actually legitimately did not know what was happening, even though they had a chance to find out. They didn't bother to, and then they've said, "Well, you know, without my," because you're not allowed to bring your staff to these to be briefed on these super sensitive programs. And so, some people are legitimately shocked. Other people are being, you know, typically hypocritical. But in fairness, too, I mean, when the public gets aroused about something, that's how the system works, right? I mean, they respond to that, and then they're getting asked about it in their town hall meetings. So, that's how Washington works.
Well, and you mentioned Senator Ron Wyden, but he seemed to be even indicating from his understanding that the NSA was collecting more than just phone records. Is there any way to know that yet?
No, and that's certainly a thing that I'm obviously trying to report on and find out about. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Wyden has hinted, because under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which is the authority they use to collect the phone metadata, it allows them to collect a lot of different kinds of records, credit card records, you know, health records even. I'm not saying they're doing this, but all sorts of business records that we deposit with corporations, which are not protected under the Fourth Amendment, according to the Supreme Court decision. And the NSA has said we only collect phone records, and they say we don't collect location data, which is very important because, you know, your cell phone bill tells people where you were when you made a call. But there's some indications that maybe some other agencies are doing that, the FBI, Treasury Department, and that's something that a lot of reporters in Washington are trying to find out.
But
collecting what?
Well, and the president and others have said, yes, we need to debate this issue. But how do you debate an issue that's so shrouded in secrecy?
Right. Well, that's shows sort of the value of the Snowden leaks for those who think that they were valuable. And, I mean, you can't deny that they've certainly allowed a debate about something that you know, heretofore was, as you said, was shrouded in secrecy. So, to the extent we don't know what else they're collecting, if it were to emerge that they were collecting other kinds of data about Americans, I think that could really tip the balance of this debate.
What's the update on Edward Snowden? And, I mean, we know that he's, at least as of 11:15 this morning, Eastern Standard Time, that he is still in that transit area at a Moscow airport. Interestingly, the Attorney General said he wouldn't be tortured, nor would he be put to death if, I guess, the Russians send him back to the United States.
Yeah, and you know, you wonder whether that was some kind of move that designed to make extradition somehow easier, or make it easier for Russia to turn him over. I mean, I saw this morning that some migration service official in Moscow said that Snowden could end up in some kind of refugee center if he leaves the airport in Moscow, because he doesn't have, you know, he's a man without a passport, so he doesn't have paperwork. I mean, Russia's in an interesting position. A lot of my sources believe that they have milked Snowden for everything he's worth in terms of his intelligence. They claim they haven't, and they claim that they're not interested in him making public any further information, but they're certainly relishing the idea of, you know, putting a stick in the eye of the American intelligence services because for this kind of surveillance, because they're obviously in an adversary position. They spy on us, we spy on them. So,
And in terms of the NSA, and we'll be talking with a former FISA court judge and also someone from the Brennan Center, but I guess going back in time, what was the original purpose of the NSA?
Well, it's a signals intelligence agency, so it was designed to break code and to steal secrets that were transmitted through over the airwaves and over wires and stuff. And the origin of this surveillance that's so controversial is that, you know, before the 9/11 attacks, a couple of hijackers came into San Diego, and one of them was calling a safe house in Yemen, and the NSA was listening to those calls, but they didn't know that the calls were coming from San Diego. And, you know, the official said, we never want that to happen again. How can we prevent it? Now, there's a lot of reporting that suggests that, I mean, that they didn't need to do this metadata program if they had just done some basic things. I mean, the CIA knew about these hijackers and didn't tell the FBI. There's a lot of sort of other things that caused them not to be detected. But intelligence officials were sort of like, we need to know who's calling, if Al-Qaeda is calling people in the U.S., we need to find out about it. So that was the rationale for gathering the phone records. But when in recent weeks, when officials are asked, well, what plots have you foiled through the collection of U.S. phone records, what they're telling people is pretty thin. I mean, the only thing they can say conclusively was foiled was basically a guy or a group of men in San Diego who were sending money to Al-Shabaab. And that's opposed to the PRISM program, which is directed at foreigners, which is that, you know, the program where they're getting data from Facebook and Microsoft and Google. That has been very successful and is not really controversial. I mean, that's sort of what the NSA, what we pay the NSA to do, is to spy on foreigners. The controversy there is to what extent American communication is being swept up in that, and whether it's properly minimized. That's the term of art they use. They, you know, black out or destroy Americans who are emails or, you know, chats or whatever that are caught up in that dragnet.
And we have about 45 seconds here, but is there any evidence that you know of that this metadata surveillance has been used against a civilian, you know, just a regular member of the U.S. public?
No, see, that's the other issue, is that with this whole sort of scandal, is that there really isn't any evidence of abuses, per se. I mean, the NSA has admitted that they've collected things they shouldn't have, and they've told Congress about it, but there's no sort of evidence of, like, the Nixon era, you know, spying on your political enemies, or even, like, you know, have innocent people been swept up and detained because of this surveillance? Nobody has come forth with any, and certainly not Snowden or anyone else. Right. I think if you saw that, that would change the picture here.
Well, Ken Delanian, thank you so much for getting our conversation started.
All right, Marty, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. He's national security correspondent in the Washington Bureau for the LA Times. We have a judge waiting in the wings, and as I said, a member or a co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, as we get an update on NSA and Edward Snowden. Stay with us. And the FISA court, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Have you lost weight in the past 2 years? Drexel University is conducting a study designed to help people prevent weight regain through exercise. In this 10-week program, you can learn how to make lasting changes to your exercise habits, which may help you avoid weight regain. If you have lost weight and want to exercise more, you may be eligible. 215-762-8400. 215-762-8400. Drexel supports WHYY.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a pretty tough quiz about the week's news. In fact, it's so tough that it drove Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock himself, to distraction.
This shouldn't be Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. This should be, come on, give me a break.
I know.
Hey, if we could do that to a Vulcan, imagine what thrills lie in store for you. Join us for this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR. Saturdays at 4 on WHYY.
Every major act topping the festival lineups, there's an unknown artist headlining small-town clubs and neighborhood garages. I'm Greg Cott.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. This week on Sound Opinions, we're digging deep for buried treasures. Join us as we spotlight some great albums buried under the top 40.
Till I'm all right, I'm coming home.
tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen. Revelations about the NSA data mining program have raised questions about the role of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Our guest, James Carr, served on that court from 2002 to 2008, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last week. He's a senior federal judge for the Northern District of Ohio. And Judge Carr, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
And you know why you were chosen to serve on this court?
Not really. Well, actually, I raised my hand. I'm the author of a legal treatise, or co-author actually now, entitled The Law of Electronic Surveillance. Huh. And so it was an area in which I was very interested, and I contacted our chief judge, our circuit, and he is the one who was contacted by the head of the administrative office, who in turn was contacted by the chief justice. So that was, as I say, back in 2001, I think I was designated and passed a security clearance and started in May of 2002 and served for 6 years.
So probably your expertise in intelligence, national security, those issues?
I would imagine, yes, generally in terms of electronic surveillance, both domestic and, and foreign.
You wrote in the New York Times last week that while you were there, this was from 2002 to 2008, that the caseload grew, quote, enormously. How enormously?
Well, I think if you look at the data, I don't really know precisely, but it was a very substantial growth. We sit by ourselves when we serve down there. There are 11 of us, and we sit for a period of days each week during a week. I started out sitting for about a day and a half or so, 2 days, and wound up sitting for 3 or 4 days, reviewing the applications, and then having them presented to me after I'd reviewed them and advised the attorney from the Justice Department that it looked acceptable to me.
One of the criticisms.
They came on in, and I go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish your point there.
Well, then they would come on in. And for instance, if I had changes I thought were necessary or something was missing, they would come in and present the final application to me, and I would sign it.
One of the criticisms of the court, I'm sure you've heard this, is that it essentially has become or became a rubber stamp approving, you know, all the requests, the government requests before them. Is that a fair charge?
I don't think it is for two reasons. First, primarily, almost exclusively, the vast majority of these applications are very fact-based. They don't raise new issues of law or difficult constitutional or statutory questions. And you look at the facts, the standard of probable cause, the basis for issuing one of these orders is very simple. It's a connection with a foreign government or a connection with a foreign-based terrorist organization. That's a very low standard of probable cause. The second reason is that, as already alluded to, we would be presented with a draft copy of the application. We review it, or I would review it, and I'm sure my colleagues did as well. If I had questions, if I had problems, I would raise them. And that was not necessarily commonplace, but on the other hand, it was not uncommon. I would notify the attorney that I had this problem or that problem, and they would either fix it or they wouldn't present it. And that would not show up in the statistics as, quote, a turndown. It was sort of a non-event. And one thing I should note as well is that the statute prohibits judge shopping. The Justice Department didn't know which judge would be sitting in a particular week or who was coming after that judge. And once an application had been presented to a particular judge, the statute requires that only that judge can consider that application in the event there was some problem with it that needed fixing and it couldn't get done while the judge was still in Washington during his or her time there.
You did, and this is, I keep referring to this piece, but that's why we wanted to have you on the show.
Sure.
And this is the piece in the New York Times last week. You do, though, call, and I'm quoting here, for authorizing its judges, and I guess that would be the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court judges, to appoint lawyers to serve the public interest when novel legal issues come before it. And I guess rather than sort of relying on your own judgment, having someone else represent the public under certain circumstances.
Exactly. And it's really a very, very modest proposal. It would not get in the way of the courts doing its day-to-day work, handling its routine docket. But from time to time, the government proposes a new program. something new and novel that raises a challenging and difficult constitutional or statutory issues. And I, speaking for myself, I felt from time to time that it would have been extremely helpful for me to be able to reach out to a security-cleared lawyer on a previously established list, have that lawyer come in, be acquainted with whatever the issue was, maybe or maybe not with the underlying facts, but with the issue, and have that lawyer present argument why the application should not be granted. And that also would do a couple of things, if I may.
Sure.
First, it would interject something like the adversary process. That's what we judges make our minds up on when we have difficult problems. But equally important, and I think particularly with regard to public confidence, that would give somebody where I had gone ahead and said, okay, it is okay, this meets constitutional statutory requirements, that lawyer could then appeal to the Foreign Intelligence Court of Review. That's an appellate judge, three appellate judges. And that doesn't exist now, because if the government gets its way, it's not going to seek further judicial review. But if there's somebody standing opposed to the application and has made the arguments, which I've rejected as a single judge, they can get appellate review. And again, that's the way courts normally function. And finally, if that lawyer were unhappy with what the Court of Review did, that lawyer could present the issue to the Supreme Court, which of course has never reviewed any of these kinds of issues or applications, because there's nobody to seek the necessary review.
One of the criticisms of the court, and even picking up on what you just said there, which was to have someone representing the other side, the side opposite the government side, on every single case, not just these unusual cases as you describe. Do you think that is in any way workable or a needed piece of reform?
It's neither workable given the volume. I think they're around 1,500 a year or so. I haven't checked, so that don't rely on that figure, but that's my impression. No, it's not workable because first of all, that's not what happens in an ordinary search warrant context. You know, a search warrant for drugs or guns or stolen money or whatever. There's never a lawyer involved at the outset. In other words, what I'm proposing is would not be found with an ordinary, typical search warrant. And as I say, these are fact-based applications. Is this person connected with a foreign-based terrorist organization? And I can only say that in many, many instances, the decision is very easy. The answer is, well, of course, indeed, go ahead. In other words, and in a fact-based situation, just as with a conventional search warrant, there's really no room or place or reason for an attorney to be there. There's nothing really to argue about, especially here where the standard of probable cause is so low, and deliberately so, and I can get into that if you wish at some point. But it's when there's a challenging and difficult legal issue that I think my proposal should be looked at and perhaps implemented.
A final question to you, and this is actually going back to an editorial in the New York Times. You probably saw it over the weekend, headlined, "More Independence for the FISA Court." There's so many deeply troubling things about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that it's difficult to know where to begin, but a good place might be the method by which the court's judges are chosen, raising questions about, the power given to the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court to select these judges. Now, he did select you. Do you think the Chief Justice has too much power when it comes to selecting judges?
Well, I would ask only, what is the alternative? I don't think that we would want to introduce or interject senatorial confirmation the way we do with when appointing me or any other federal judge to our lifetime position. I think particularly recent past, but for some time now, it's often very difficult to get judges through the Senate. It took my successor when I took senior status 2 years to get through and get confirmed. And the court has 11 judges, and it is extra work that we all do, and it's significant and important work. And to leave that institution shorthanded, given its volume, could, I think, create serious problems. So I do not think that senatorial, you know, presidential appointment or even chief justice designation followed by a congressional confirmation hearing and so forth and all the delays that that would involve really is an answer. The chief judge has and has always had, the chief justice has and has always had that discretion. I noticed the article that preceded the editorial. I did not see the editorial. Candidly, I really don't have an answer for that problem. I think it is a political issue and one that I suspect others will look at and comment on.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you joined us today in Radio Times. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
And that's You're very welcome. And that's Judge James Carr. He currently is a senior federal judge for the Northern District of Ohio. And from 2002 to 2008, he served on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and had a piece last week in the New York Times. Well, joining us now is Elizabeth Goitein, and she's co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. And, Liza, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much for having me.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about the NSA, the FISA court, Edward Snowden, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Liza, I know you've been listening in for the first half of the show here, but let me just get you to respond to Judge Carr's proposal, but also his critique of, not having lawyers representing the other side on all cases before the FISA court.
I certainly agree with him, and he's actually not the only judge who has served on the FISA court to have said something like that. Judge Robertson has also publicly said that the lack of an adversarial process is a real problem, and it's not that judges, don't have integrity and aren't trying to see both sides of the issue, but as Judge Robertson said, there have been many times when he's operating under a normal court situation, when he reads one side's brief and thinks, oh, yes, that makes sense. Then he reads the other side's brief and he says, wait a minute, that makes sense too. So it really is the way that legal issues are decided in our system and usually factual issues as well. I would just raise one caution here, which is that the adversary process will not solve everything with the FISA court and with some of the issues we're having with these programs. And just to give an example, Judge Carr was talking about the process of granting warrants and saying, this is very straightforward. You actually just look to see if there's a connection with a foreign power. That's true for situations in which the court grants individual orders, but Congress has taken the FISA court out of the business of granting individualized orders or reviewing individualized cases for Americans' international communications. And for those communications, all that the FISA court gets to do is look at the government's procedures for targeting and for minimizing the information it collects, and then it blesses the entire program, and the program runs for a year while the government collects what it decides to collect. I don't know how much it's going to help in that situation to have adversariality. It might help in terms of reviewing the procedures.
Right.
All of this is to say that there are problems that go far deeper and far beyond just whether you have the other side showing up in court.
But what's so interesting when you look back at the FISA court, its evolution over time, it was originally created as a kind of check on executive power. And I'm not saying it's a rubber stamp, but it seems to its mission or what it is actually doing has changed over time.
That's absolutely right. And I think it certainly was an improvement at the time that it came about in the 1970s from what had come before. But as you say, its mission has really changed. It was fairly narrowly looking at foreign-to-foreign communications. The government had leeway to collect foreign-to-foreign communications, but it was basically involved in approving any sort of surveillance in America, wire surveillance that involved an American. And that has really changed to the point that it is granting, as I said, these broad programmatic approvals for the government to go and collect Americans' information, Americans' international phone calls. And so really we're talking about situations where more oversight rather than less is needed. And yet the court is having less and less of a role in this as Congress has dictated.
But do you see it as a rubber stamp, this court?
I don't. I don't see it as a rubber stamp. And I don't question the integrity of the judges who sit on the court. I just think that structurally, it's inevitable that a court that operates in secret and hears only one side of the arguments and can't be appealed and has the same attorneys from the government appearing day after day, week after week, so it's really, you know, repeat players, I just think it's impossible to avoid a high degree of error in the results that you're getting and a certain amount of capture of the court by the agencies that it works with. Again, not to impugn the integrity of the judges. It really is just a structural problem with the institution.
Do you see a difference between data mining, which is just, you know, gathering all this information, and wiretapping?
Well, I think it depends what you mean, but I assume you're talking about the distinction between collecting phone records and collecting actual content.
Yes, listening
and,
in.
Right. And I think that there is a distinction, and I think that distinction, however, has become less and less and less with the advent of technology, to the point that we are now at a place where sometimes the collection and analysis of metadata, of phone records, can be as revealing or even more revealing than communications. And I think that people, when they rely on, you know, there's an older Supreme Court opinion that talks about telephone records from a very different time. It's different now. The kinds of information that we generate through our cell phone usage, through our internet usage, there is much, much more of that information. It's more revealing. And perhaps even more significantly, the government is able to glean more information from the sort of raw material by virtue of some very sophisticated computer algorithms.
And we're almost up on a break here, but I mean, besides location, I'm trying to think all the things that we give away about ourselves when we're making a phone call. What else?
Well, there's who you're calling, there's when you're calling them, there's how long you talk to them, there's how often, there is your location. You piece all of that together and run programs on it. It may not seem, if you or I were sitting there looking through reams and reams of somebody's phone records, we would probably give up and not know what to make of it. But a computer can very quickly tell you, you know, flag certain relationships and say, this is an unusual relationship. These phone calls happen at strange times, or they all were clustered around this event of political importance that happened. You know, they can really develop a very a surprisingly detailed picture of a person's associations and activities and even in some cases their beliefs.
Let me take a very short break, get back to our conversation. That's Elizabeth Goitein. She's a co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, doing a kind of an update on the NSA data mining, some of the revelations from Edward Snowden from, gosh, almost 2 months ago. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents Michael Feinstein and Tony Award winners Christine Ebersole and Betty Buckley in an evening of Broadway and the American Songbook's greatest hits, Friday, August 2nd. A night with the ambassador of the American Songbook and two Broadway legends that the whole family can enjoy. Tickets for Michael Feinstein and Friends, Friday, August 2nd, and all Mann concerts are available at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
Sensors and data services are helping us track so much in our lives. Our sleep patterns, our moods, how many steps we take. And in some households, they help us track the well-being of the chronically ill.
We track all of his signs and symptoms and his medications and his treatments and his calories and just about everything about him.
On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, the quantified self movement as a tool for good health. Today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we don't ask the usual questions of our celebrity guests, and we don't get the usual answers. Here's legendary anchorman Tom Brokaw making a startling admission.
You can tell where my inclinations are. I'll take nipples over body odor any day.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz that practically guarantees too much information. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR. Saturdays at 4 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Elizabeth Goitein, and she is, as I said before, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. We're talking about some of the legal, security, and privacy issues raised by the Edward Snowden case and the revelations about the NSA spying program or surveillance program, data gathering program. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Liza, I do want to get to our callers, but just picking up on something you said right before we had to go to break, that through these algorithms, people's associations can be detailed or understood. What political associations?
Sure. I mean, they can determine if you're calling phone numbers that are associated with certain political organizations or, you know, social movement organizations. They can determine on a more personal level, you know, whether you're making, you know, regular calls to a psychiatrist or to, a Planned Parenthood or Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it's really, they can determine some very sensitive information. I mean, what they'll tell you is all we have is numbers. We don't have, who that number belongs to. But obviously they can get who that number belongs to. So, you know, the question isn't what do they claim that they are doing with the data that they've collected. The question is what could they do with that data, right? And that's why we care about what is collected in the first instance, because once it's collected, once the government has it, we are relying on the government to police itself for in terms of how it uses that information. And, you know, that's a very vulnerable place for the public to be in, and that's why these restrictions, these limitations, have been at the point where the government seeks collection and not after they have the data.
Because those defending the government program say, they tell us that this information has not been abused and that we should trust the government, that they have our best interests in mind and that they are concerned about national security and it's important to protect us from people with bad intent.
Right, right. But I mean, they have said, you know, there have been no abuses, you know, trust us. And, you know, I would say that, I think it was Ken was saying, you know, we haven't seen any of the kinds of abuses from the Nixon era. Well, you know, it took the Church Committee to actually reveal those abuses. It took a very concerted effort by a special committee with subpoena power to find out about what had been happening for decades, and no one knew before then. So, you know, we don't know if there have been abuses. We don't. We may find out, but let's assume that there haven't been abuses. That's not the question. The question is, what is the potential for abuse of this practice? And do we want to say, for all time, we trust everyone we're going to elect to office to have this kind of power over our lives? And we're not worried about who's in office 4 years or 8 years or 12 years from now, and we just are willing to sort of write a blank check for our trust. And to me, that's not the purpose of the protections that we have in law and in our Constitution.
Going forward and even looking at how you would then reform the system, so we've got, you know, a certain expectation of privacy. The government obviously concerned about national security. And then, of course, we have, you know, technology and the fact that people are on their cell phones 24/7. How would you rewrite or reduce, you know, some of this system, the FISA court to NSA?
Right. Well, if you look back at the history, as I just mentioned, there were abuses that went on for decades during the Cold War, and then reforms that were put in place after the Church Committee. And those reforms established a kind of golden rule that our government, our law enforcement and intelligence agencies would not collect information about Americans unless it had some reason, some reasonable basis for some kind of suspicion of wrongdoing. And that golden rule was reflected in a number of laws and policies, including the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And then since 9/11, and those laws were in place for decades, and they worked quite well. I mean, the 9/11 Commission found fault with a lot of government practices, but it never said, you know, we should have collected more information about Americans with less suspicion. But since 9/11, we have seen this standard, this golden rule, just dramatically weakened very rapidly across a range of laws and policies. And that's what we're seeing in this case, is the broad collection of information about Americans with no reason for suspicion. And that's what I would change. I would get to work kind of reinstating this golden rule that has in the past really been shown to strike the right balance between our privacy and our security.
So the idea is a more targeted surveillance versus the kind of mass surveillance that's going on today.
Absolutely, and there's plenty of reason to believe that more targeted surveillance is actually more effective, and that just sort of drowning the government and all of this data is not really the best way to find the terrorists.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-WHYY. We have been following the Edward Snowden NSA story for some time now, done several shows, and obviously this is our most current one. Let me see what Rose from Flemington has to say. Rose, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This morning I was listening to the radio. I didn't really quite catch the whole deal, but it was Saxby Chambliss, who seems to be the head of the committee that was discussing this issue last week, was asked, well, are you collecting anything on Americans, and has it ever happened? And he said, oh, we stopped that 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
As a person who grew up, you know, watching the HUAC and Watergate and this and that, I think it's opening a door to American curiosity. We're not going to be so apathetic about this type of intrusion into our lives. And most of all, I think that we have the right to ask, how much did it really cost? Not only financially, but in the sense, it seems to be just a real mad dash to cover, you know, to cover their butts over the issues that were not dealt with before 9/11.
Well, Rose, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mean, it's interesting if that's what Senator Saxby Chambliss was saying, that you look at what Senator Ron Wyden is saying and trying to figure out what the government knows and what it is doing. Your thoughts, Liza?
Well, there's a specific program that this administration put an end to, or says it put an end to, back in 2011, which I assume is what was being referred to, and
right.
That was a program of collection of Internet metadata that was taking place under something called the Pen Register Statute. We don't know if there has been a different process or a different procedure to capture some of the same information under a different legal authority, which is essentially what we've seen is almost a game of musical chairs with different legal authorities to continue the same practices while shifting them, shoehorning them into different statutes, or in some cases, no statute at all. So we just don't know. I can't remember who said this earlier, but it is very difficult to have a public debate, which is what the president says he welcomes, when there's so much information that is still not public. And it's difficult to do the analysis that I believe the caller was talking about, which is what are the costs? What are the costs and what are the benefits? And that is a decision the public should be making, because it's our privacy that's at stake. And unfortunately, our government has not given us the information we need to make that decision.
Rose, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. This is getting into the weeds, but these, I think, are very important weeds. This is Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And I have here some of the language. The director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation may make an application for an order requiring the production of any tangible things, including books, records, papers, documents, and other items. The idea is that they can have access to people's access to these tangible things. Does that language concern you?
Well, the tangible things part of it is actually not as concerning to me as some other parts of the statute. It is true that before 2001, the business records provision was narrower. There was a much narrower subset of records that the government was allowed to obtain. So yes, I mean, it is tangible thing is quite broad and possibly too broad. But in the past, business records could only be obtained under some kind of showing that the person who is the subject of those records was an agent or associated with a foreign power in some ways. And that has changed. And now all that's required is this standard of relevance to an authorized foreign intelligence or international terrorism investigation, which may sound fine. It may sound like a reasonable limitation. The problem is twofold. First of all, the way relevance has been interpreted as a legal standard is a very, very, very low bar, very easy for the government to get past. And the second problem is apparently even that bar was considered too much because this program essentially dispenses with any showing of relevance. Now, somehow, the FISA court came up with an interpretation that allowed this collection to go forward under the relevant standard. But you and I can agree, I think, and your listeners can all agree, that our personal telephone records, my records, your records, are not relevant to a foreign intelligence or international terrorism investigation. So clearly, there has been a sort of perversion of that standard.
Let me get back to our callers and we'll find out. 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Julius from Ardmore to join us on Radio Times. And Julius, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I think this whole debate sort of begs the question how we feel about social media sort of observation and data collection to maybe identify gun owners who are unhinged and people that are potentially going to be mass shooters, which I think is something we see a lot more of the impact of than terrorism. And I wonder how maybe we feel about this as a society ethically and if there's a legal apparatus or precedent to sort of collect information on this basis and maybe set up tags on people in databases that are buying guns or something.
I mean, are you suggesting that, Julius? Because I'm not sure anyone could reliably and 100% predict when someone is going to be a mass murderer.
Sure, but I think maybe if there was a system of sort of warning tags that could be evidence in social media, because I think we always go back when someone commits a horrendous mass murder and we sort of look at what was their social media presence like. Were there any red flags that we could have, you know, stepped in and said this person's having a schizophrenic break and maybe violent or something?
Yeah, I don't know. It feels like thin ice to me, but let me see what our guest has to say. Liza, what do you think?
Well, so the science of this, the social science of this is something that I'm familiar with, certainly in the terrorism context, and that is, yes, in retrospect, you can say, you know, this person said scary things on Facebook. But the relevant question is how many people said scary things on Facebook and then did nothing? And is the proportion of people who actually do scary things who said something on Facebook different from those who didn't? And really what the evidence on terrorism shows is that there is no way. This is what's so interesting. I mean, these computer algorithms can tell you so much about your life that the government has no business knowing. The one thing that these algorithms have not successfully been able to show is the one thing the government says it's looking for, which is evidence that somebody is going to commit a violent act. Violence is notoriously difficult to predict, even with the best of computer algorithms, because the factors are just so variable, and there are so few incidents of actual, certainly significant terrorist attacks. And so it's slightly ironic in a way that this intrusion of privacy, which is very significant, is actually based on a pretty thin empirical theoretical basis.
Julius, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Lasse, do you think, though, and this is just broadly speaking, that the public gives away so much information about themselves kind of willy-nilly because of the convenience of technology, but perhaps should think twice before doing some of those things?
Well, it's hard. I mean, it's very difficult in today's society to get through 24 hours without giving some very, very personal information to your internet service provider or, you know, putting it into your iPhone, you're giving it to a carrier. So it's very hard, and I think people have, very, very easily made that decision to share that information with Google or whoever. I think people have not been aware how much of that information can go to the government, how easily it can go to the government. I actually think if you open something, on your iPhone and a window popped up that said, do you give permission to share this information that you were about to share with Google Maps to the FBI? I think most people would hit no if they had that choice. So the fact that people are willingly disclosing their information on Facebook or wherever, I think we should not assume from that everybody's okay with, dragnet surveillance by the government.
Do you think Edward Snowden did the country a public service?
Yes.
I appreciate that exhale. Go ahead,
yeah,
Liza.
I think so, but I think the story is more complicated than that. I think it is in the public interest to have this debate. I think it's very important to talk about these issues, and I think that much of the information that he disclosed had no business being classified and withheld from the public. I'm not ready to say that's true for everything that he disclosed, and I'm not ready to say it's true for what he might disclose in the future. So, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you, you know, I think he's a hero or anything like that. You know, I think it's a very dicey game that we play when we keep too many secrets as a country, because then we rely on leakers to be the ones, to be the sort of pressure valve that lets out the secrets that shouldn't be kept. But, of course, the worry is that that whatever is leaked will include secrets that could be kept, and that's why it would be so much better for the government to put its own house in order and stop keeping secret from the American people things we have a right to know.
Well, Elizabeth Goitein, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. She's co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Also spoke with James Carr, senior federal judge in Ohio, served on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And we began with Ken Delanian, national security correspondent for the L.A. Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Nick Sessler, our intern for today's edition of the show. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.